Chemical Watch podcast.
Unlock the full value of your compliance and product stewardship with world-leading insight and intelligence from Chemical Watch. To find out more or request a demo, visit chemicalwatch.com. Chemical Watch. Intelligence to transform product safety.
Hello, this is Kate Lowe, Global Managing Editor of Chemical Watch, welcoming you to this week's news podcast hosted by members of the Chemical Watch team. We aim to take you a little further behind the headlines and provide you with fresh insight into developments in the world of chemicals management. For today's episode, I'm joined from Washington, D.C. by our North America Managing Editor, Terry Hyland, and from the UK by our Biocides Editor, Vanessa Zainzinger, and Business Editor, Lee Stringer. We have three developments we'll be focusing on today. Firstly, we'll be looking at an apparent upturn in requests to the US Environmental Protection Agency to consider exempting certain critical uses from potential regulatory activity under the Toxic Substances Control Act, or TSCA, a development which appears to be driven by a ramping up of risk management activity under the amended law. Second, we'll be turning to Europe and what happens when derogations that were made under a clause in the Biocidal Products Regulation for the mass production of disinfectants in the wake of COVID-19 expire in September. Finally, staying with Europe, we'll be exploring ongoing concerns over industry's readiness to submit data on substances of concern in products to ECHA's SCIP database, concerns which have been most recently articulated by Technology and Engineering Trade Association, or GELIM. So let's begin with the US, where several companies and at least one federal agency have asked the Environmental Protection Agency to consider exempting certain critical uses from potential regulatory activity under TSCA. So Terry, firstly, can you tell us a little more about these critical use exemption requests?
Sure. Hey, Kate. Well, our reporter John Kelby looked at requests by several companies seeking exemptions in response to the EPA's proposed partial ban on phenol isopropylated phosphate 3-1, also known as PIP3-1. Now, that is one of five persistent bioaccumulative and toxic substances that the EPA must finalize risk management rules for by this December. And PIP3-1 has many uses. It can be used as a flame retardant, including as a coating in steel to help help steel keep its structure during a fire. It can be used as a lubricant, a hydraulic fluid, and as a solvent in many things, including in photographic printing paper. So it's also has a negative side. It's toxic to aquatic plants and animals and could potentially have negative reproductive, developmental, and neurological effects. So as a result, EPA has proposed to prohibit the processing and distribution of PIP3-1 for many of its uses, with some exceptions for things like in the aviation and automotive industries, and for some uses as lubricants and greases. Well, companies then like Fujifilm and Hempel, which produces protective coatings, are seeking an exemption from this potential ban on PIP3-1, and they're using Section 6G of TSCA. And that provision of the law gives EPA the power to exempt specific uses from a risk management rule if it determines they are critical or essential uses, and that there are no technically and economically feasible, safer alternatives available. And it also says an exemption can be granted for other things. So for specific uses, if prohibiting those might threaten national security or the economy or infrastructure, or if a use provides such a particular benefit to human health, the environment, or public safety compared to other alternatives. Now, Fujifilm and Hempel have asked EPA for that critical use exemption. Fujifilm, in comments to the EPA, say that without PIP3-1, its photographic prints won't come out as sharp or as clear. And Hempel says the substance is needed in coatings to protect steel structures from deformation in the case of fires.
Okay, thanks, Terry. Can we expect more of these exemption requests with the EPA set to issue risk evaluations for 9 more chemicals this year and risk assessments for 20 more?
The short answer, yes. So as I had said earlier, the rule for PIP3-1 is one of just five rules for PBTs that are expected this December. And there could be many more rules restricting the use of chemicals over the next few years. Now, as you probably know, the EPA completed its first risk evaluation under the amended TSCA in June. That was for methylene chloride. And completing that evaluation kicked off a two-year period to finalize a rule to manage nearly 50 uses of that chemical that EPA said present an unreasonable risk. And as you had mentioned, there are nine more of those final risk evaluations expected by the end of this year, with risk management rules likely to follow those. And then another 20 substances are undergoing risk evaluation. So you could potentially have risk management rules with restrictions for nearly three dozen substances over the next handful of years. And that's potentially a big deal for a company that might be using one of these chemicals and doesn't see a clear, viable alternative. In fact, in Hempel's request, in their comment to the EPA, they said there is a potential alternative to PIP3-1, but that alternative is triphenylphosphate, or TPP, which is one of those 20 high priority substances undergoing risk evaluation. So Hempel told the EPA, they said, well, we can't assume TPP will be an acceptable substitute for PIP3-1. So they're going ahead and putting in that request for an exemption now. And a federal agency, NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, has also told the EPA that it sees critical uses for 13 of those next 20 high priority chemicals under review, for things ranging from flame retardants to chemicals used in research and analyzing certain materials. Now, NASA didn't specifically request a critical use exemption for any uses of those substances, at least not yet, but its comments to the agency highlight the variety of complicated uses for these different chemicals.
Okay, so what should companies be doing now? Do these exemption requests have to be completed by a certain time?
Well, companies that believe they have critical uses for these substances probably should be doing just what NASA is, which is engaging the EPA, talking to the EPA. There isn't a set time limit. The exemption section of TSCA 6G says the critical use exemption can be included as part of the regular rulemaking or as a separate process. So that means the EPA could include a critical use exemption when it issues a risk mitigation rule, or it could do so after that rule is finalized. The problem is there's not a lot of guidance out there about what these critical use exemption requests should look like and what information a company might have to include in them. And part of that reason is this has been a pretty dormant area for many years. There's been very little rulemaking around risk management under TSCA until very recently. So, for example, Fujifilm, in its letter seeking an exemption for PIP3-1, said they couldn't find any rule or guidance on how to submit a critical use exemption. So they basically were just giving it their best shot. And it's also not clear how much EPA has to explain its reasoning if it grants or denies a critical use exemption. So that means industry won't have a lot of information to go on or learn from if an exemption is granted or not. And the EPA has said that it encourages any stakeholders to submit their comments as early as possible in the process, so the agency has plenty of time to consider the information and whether it should be a critical use or not. It's also said that companies should feel free to reach out to the EPA if questions regarding critical use exemptions come up. And there may be another reason to build that record of information with the EPA, and that's if there's litigation down the road. If there is a legal challenge to a final rule from the EPA, a court could potentially overturn a final rule if it finds that a decision the EPA made was not supported by substantial evidence, looking at the whole body of the rulemaking record. So establishing that information in the process of the rulemaking, submitting comments, that sort of thing, establishing that information in a rulemaking for any of these substances could help one's case if a final decision on one of these chemicals ultimately ends up in court.
Okay, thanks so much, Terry. So now let's turn our attention to Europe, where industry is facing a potential cliff edge next month when the majority of derogations made under a clause in the Biocidal Products Regulation for the mass production of disinfectants in the wake of COVID-19 will expire. Vanessa, so can you explain why suppliers and purchasers of disinfectants, which have been vital in the fight against COVID-19, now are facing this cliff edge?
Yes, absolutely. Hi, Kate. So when the pandemic began sweeping across Europe earlier this year, disinfectants were in such high demand that we experienced a supply shortage, and meeting this really exceptional, never seen before demand with new products was just not possible under the normal market authorization requirements of the EU Biocidal Products Regulation, the BPR for short, because the requirements under this law are very strict and very lengthy, time consuming, and they're just not built for this kind of quick access to market that was needed when the pandemic hit. So what European member states did, European countries, is they individually began exempting certain disinfectants from these strict legal requirements. And they did so by implementing a derogation under the Article 55 of the BPR, which is made just for this kind of situation. It allows countries individually to put aside the standard authorization requirements in a public health emergency in order to get products to market. Now, this was a really good solution at the time, and it helped Europe meet demands. But these derogations are legally only allowed to last for a maximum of 180 days. And while EU member states, they implemented the derogation at different times and for different length of times, but the majority of them will expire in September, so next month. And once they do, all of those hand sanitizers and surface disinfectants that companies fast track to market, they will suddenly be illegal because they don't have the full proper market authorization under the BPR. And that will put producers and suppliers in a really tough position of having to either withdraw the disinfectants from the market because they're there illegally now, or to go through the full time-consuming, expensive authorization process, which will take a lot of time and means that they would still have to take them off the market until that's actually done. And on top of that, it would no doubt be quite a shock for certain companies that pivoted to producing disinfectants during the crisis, which are in some cases companies that really aren't familiar at all with the legal system for biocides, such as distilleries using alcohol for producing hand sanitizer.
Okay, so now I understand that there are two options for producers looking to continue production beyond September. Can you tell us more about these and their pros and cons?
Sure. In fact, I would say there are three options. The first one just being the default by which these derogations that we just talked about expire and they aren't followed up by any other measures. And in this case, we would be at this cliff edge that you talked about earlier. And we would probably see a new drain on disinfectant supplies, I imagine. But the second option is that these Article 55 derogations can be extended for a further 550 days. By the European Commission, if that's necessary, if the situation warrants this. And the national authority of each European member state who wants to extend the derogation has to request this from the European Commission. And this is a good option and designed just for a situation just like the one we find ourselves in. But the potential downside is that such an extension would have to undergo a scrutiny process that involves the European Parliament, and could certainly be blocked or derailed and take a bit of time. There is a third option, and that is that national authorities could simply adopt a new derogation again, which couldn't be exactly word for word the same as the first one, as this first round of derogations that is about to expire. But if it's ever so slightly different, it is theoretically possible and totally legal to just adopt another derogation for another 180 days. And to do this until the situation has developed to a point where supply and demand is under control and we found a way out of this cliff edge situation. I would say, remember, this is all really new ground for everyone involved. This is the first time ever that an Article 55 derogation has been used, let alone reused or extended. So what obstacles we could come across in the process at this point is anyone's guess, really, I think.
Okay, thanks, Vanessa. At the Chemical Watch webinar on this issue, Darren Abrahams from Steptoe & Johnson pointed out that national biocides authorities need to tread carefully not to give an impression of allowing disinfectant producers to bypass the law. This issue stems from the fact that there has been an increase in illegal disinfectant products entering the market under the sort of loosened rules. So how bad has this problem been, and what can the authorities do about it?
Yes, well, so each national authority in Europe is currently doing its own market monitoring and enforcement. And you're right, many of them have reported a spike in illegal products on their markets. To give you one example, a good example is Denmark. They've been keeping a very close eye on this and regularly reported on this. And the EPA in Denmark has said there are what they call extraordinary numbers of alerts regarding illegal disinfectant products that they're getting from the country's customs agency since mid-March, when the pandemic began to become a real problem in Europe. This is definitely a problem. Sometimes these products are just labeled in a misleading way, and sometimes they can be very dangerous to human health. We even know of cases in the US where hand sanitizers just on the market contain methanol instead of ethanol, for example, which is very dangerous. And it's I would say it's important to note, though, that this issue in Europe is not necessarily due to these exemptions just opening up the market to any old products that somebody has mixed together in their basement. The exemptions that we talked about are really only fast-tracking market access for specific products, often WHO-approved formulations that are proven to be safe and effective, but companies are not exempt from the law. So this surge in illegal products is not necessarily connected to the exemptions allowing this. It's just that this kind of demand for disinfectants presents quite a money-making opportunity for rogue producers, a foreseeable problem, I would have thought. So the authorities are already doing this, but they will have to continue watching this problem very closely, working together with their customs agencies to avoid illegal products coming in, and perhaps working with industry as well, because the biocides industry really is the last to want to see illegal disinfectants on the shelves. Legit biocides companies have to comply with a very strict law under the BPR, and they will hate to see bad apples trying to bypass it and giving the industry a bad name. But it is a problem to watch for the next few months for sure.
Okay, thanks very much, Vanessa. So finally, let's turn to the ongoing concerns regarding the SCIP database. Now, just to recap, the database came out of the revised Waste Framework Directive, which requires suppliers to communicate information related to articles placed on the market and containing candidate list substances above 0.1% weight by weight from the 1st of January 2021. The requirement has triggered ongoing concerns from certain sectors within the industry, and most recently from Trade Association Orgelim. So Lee, can you tell us more about the concerns of the Engineering Trade Association?
Thanks, Kate. So a bit of background for context. The SCIP database forms part of the EU circular economy package to develop non-toxic material cycles. And that's so that recycled waste can be used as a major and reliable source of raw materials, and obviously free from hazardous chemicals. So the information submitted is mainly to inform waste operators of what SVHCs are in the waste they receive. Now, the European Technology, as you've said, Kate, and Engineering Trade Association, Orgelim, is one of a number of industry organisations that have raised concerns with the database since it was agreed by EU authorities in 2018. And we've been hearing a lot about this and obviously reporting on it over the last couple of years. Now, the main argument from industry is that the information required exceeds that of REACH Article 33, and that this is the information that's required through the database. So Article 33 requires any supplier of an article containing an SVHC in a concentration above 0.1% weight by weight shall provide the consumer with sufficient information to allow the safe use of the article, including as a minimum the name of the substance. Now, the information obligations set out under the database have specific fields. And this includes concentration ranges and material categories. And it's here that industry says Article 33 is being exceeded. So obtaining and submitting this information is of concern because of the high number of notifications required, particularly for companies making complex articles such as the automotive and aerospace sectors. And they've been particularly vocal. For example, the Aerospace and Defence Industries Association in Europe estimates that more than 1 million notifications will be submitted by the sector to the database in 2021. And so notifications per company, it says, are expected to span from below 100 up to 200,000. Putting figures on it, the European Automobile Manufacturers Industry Association, ACEA, communicated to the Commission that estimated costs to the EU industry, automotive industry, of complying with the database under different scenarios will range from 801 million euros to 8.5 billion, with a realistic estimate, it says, of 1.9. So because of all this, Orgelim is in a position paper on the database said the majority of companies in the EU will not be ready to comply with the obligations required under ECHA's database. And the association, along with others, such as ACEA as well, continued to call for a delay in the January 2021 notification deadline. And that's because they're wanting to see an impact assessment by the European Commission and member states on the feasibility and the outcomes of the database.
Okay, thanks very much, Lee. So how has ECHA responded to these most recent concerns?
Yeah, so we've spoken to ECHA and we've spoken to the Commission, and the European Commission actually told us just over a week ago that it won't be carrying out such an assessment prior to or following the 2021 deadline. Now, it says because the database legal obligations were introduced by the co-legislators in the very late stages of the legislative procedure, they weren't supported by an impact assessment. And so, therefore, it's continuing to encourage companies to do what's possible to fulfil their legal obligations. And they told us that, you know, they've still got a number of months to prepare for the notification obligations. Now, moving to the Article 33 argument, both the Commission and ECHA have consistently reiterated their positions that most suppliers of articles must already be communicating this information in their supply chains and should have put in place procedures in order to fulfill Article 33. So when preparing the information requirements for the skip notifications, the agency took into account the relevant legal text, it said, from the Waste Framework Directive, the REACH regulation, the September 2015 European Court of Justice ruling on articles, the European Commission's non-paper on the implementation of Articles 9 and 9.2 of the revised Waste Framework Directive, and also the guidance on requirements for substances and articles. And it pinpointed and highlighted this because it said the guidance document was last updated in 2017 by consulting experts from industry, member states, and the agency's forum, and was endorsed by Caracal. So it's saying, therefore, it represents a compromise between all relevant stakeholders regarding the interpretation and implementation of REACH Article 33.
Okay, thanks, Lee. So with the deadline for compliance with the requirement looming, you know, what are the next steps?
Yeah, well, I don't think we're going to there's not going to be any quieting down of concerns raised by industry. I think they're still going to be pushing for delays and alterations. But as we've heard from the Commission and as we've heard from ECHA, it's kind of going ahead as planned. There's currently a prototype of the database available for companies to test the system, and this was launched in February. October will be when the official version of the database is launched to allow companies time to get used to it and sort of deal with the information obligations and the fields within that. And as we've mentioned, then the companies will need to submit notifications from the 5th of January 2021. But as I say, this is not going to be quietening down. Industry is certainly going to be pushing for changes.
Okay, thanks again, Lee. That's it for today. So thank you again to Terry, Vanessa and Lee for sharing their insight into today's stories with us. And thank you to our audience for listening to today's episode. We hope you found it valuable. If you'd like to find out more about the topics from today's discussion, please head over to the Chemical Watch website at chemicalwatch.com. We hope you can join us again for next week's news podcast. And until then, goodbye.
Unlock the full value of your compliance and product stewardship with world-leading insight and intelligence from Chemical Watch. To find out more or request a demo, visit chemicalwatch.com. Chemical Watch. Intelligence to transform product safety.
The Chemical Watch Podcast.